Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the July 2024 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research. So here with the PCRF Journal Club, we will take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. Big thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring you the best of science in education. I'm Megan Corey, and I'm here today with Michael Caduce and Katie O'Connor, and soon to join us will be Dr. Bill Toon. Today, we are going to chew on this really interesting article. This is an article entitled Bringing Competency-Based Communication Training to Scale, a Multi-Institutional Virtual Simulation-Based Mastery Learning Curriculum for Emergency Medicine Residents. A mouthful, but and a lot to go to unpack here. So this was published in May of this year, 2024, in the journal, one of my favorites, Medical Teacher. Now, remember, if you miss any of these, and let me forward here for those of you who are watching, you miss any of these, you can always go, and this is the including the clinical journal clubs or the educational research journal clubs. We've got a nice archive going. You can always go to youtube.com/@PCRA@UCLA and you can, PCRF at UCLA. And you can, watch past episodes or, peruse our library there. So join us there. That's a great little library we've got. So thanks for joining us today. Let's begin. We're going to remind our listeners that you can use the chat feature to bring in those conversations and have and also to refer to a few articles and things that and links that we will be posting in that chat. So if you want to get some of those links, you can go to the chat and then you can type in your questions. We can bring those in as we go. So let's look at this article. This is Bringing Competency-Based Communications Training. So there's a lot to unpack in this article, but really this is primarily educational issues we're going to focus on. This is an education research journal club, but it does focus around a competency that is embedded in the emergency medicine residency. That is a competency really that we talk about a lot for EMS practitioners. So it's an issue when it comes to, training EMS practitioners, and that's communications. So therapeutic communications with patients. In particular, they focus on training and communication skills around breaking bad news. And there's a lot of evidence that high quality communication skills can increase patient and family trust and satisfaction with their healthcare. And also, the other thing I think was interesting is that it can increase the satisfaction of the providers themselves, of the healthcare professionals, which may, again, we talk so much about burnout, may actually have an impact on burnout. There's so many like possibilities with this whole concept of having good training and preparation and communication skills. We didn't really talk about that, Michael, before coming on here, but this has so many like areas of relevance.
Yeah, I think, and good morning, Katie. I think too, like the times that I think if I recorded the first time I had to deliver like a death notification, I would look back and probably cringe and maybe like go like lay in bed for a couple of days because of probably how horrible we did. And you think back to like the ramifications for the families for that. And part of it is like, because we don't do a lot of this in initial education, right? The assumption, and I think if you ask most providers, would be like, well, they're going to watch it be done a few times in the field. And I think if you have a robust system that has good field training and things like that, then maybe that's true. But I also think to many of the providers in rural America, we're like, as the paramedic, you are the most experienced person day one. And so
Yeah.
you are sort of expected to be able to do this. So I think any means we have to try and improve this level of training and initial education, even if it's just like I really want their curriculum, because even just being able to provide this online training about doing death notifications has to be better than what we're currently doing, which is, probably null.
Yeah, and in graduate surveys for the I'm a program director for a paramedic program, and in our graduate surveys, I've received that feedback at times where it's it would be great if we had more training in death notification or in breaking bad news in general. I felt really unprepared for that at certain. So it's definitely out there that even after they're working for a year, they really feel like, wow, if we had a little bit more like structured training here. And there is evidence-based curricula out there. That's the interesting thing here too. So training and communication skills is kind of the foundation, but the other thing that they're really recognizing here is that simulation-based mastery learning. So the way that this is taught is a piece of this as well. So mastery learning itself, teasing that apart, and we'll go through that in their protocol. The concept of competency-based education rather than time-based is sort of another key issue here. So we tend to program things based on time rather than the development of competency and deliberate practice and mastery learning. When you went that whole cycle of deliberate practice, mastering something until you actually get it is an equity pedagogy, right? It means that you're going to teach until, and they're going to practice and they're going to get the feedback until they've mastered this. And so everyone might be at a little bit of a different time, but they're given the same opportunity. So that's the kind of method promoted here that has a lot of evidence. And it so happens that the authors here are from a couple of institutions that have a lot of publications, a lot of research on this, especially Northwestern. University of Pittsburgh is the other one here. I'm not familiar with the one in Delaware, ChristianaCare, but I know that Northwestern, they've got they've got a podcast called Simulation in Healthcare Education. They have a textbook, a series called Comprehensive Healthcare Simulation Mastery Learning in Health Professions Education. That is just a guide to how to do this. So we're talking about some pretty innovative, places that are running the evidence, that are kind of centering the evidence. So this is a terrific article to show from places that actually know what they're doing. But they recognize that there's time and resource barriers to using simulation-based learning best practices. So a mastery learning best practices in terms of training faculty and preparing standardized patients and the time spent on certain things. So what they really wanted to address in this study was the scalability. So can you see that's been a barrier? We know that training and communication skills is a barrier, the lack of that time and resource barriers exist. And then scaling this, how do you scale it? Can you do it? You can do it at this innovative center, but can you do it at my college? Or your, house or Katie's place. Can we all do these same things? And so that's what they wanted to really address with this, which I thought was interesting.
I thought that was the really important part here too, Megan, because we think of like, okay, now I have to bring in subject matter experts to rank the candidates. I also have to bring in the patients who, and in this study at least, have training in doing this. So I think as program educators and paramedic and EMS educators are out there thinking like, how can you do this? They're looking at scalability. You probably don't have to do it this exact same way, but can you pull some of the things from this to incorporate it into your EMS education so it fits what resources you have available to you.
And can you even develop like a long range plan? I mean, to putting it into your long range planning, this year we're going to develop a faculty team, and some training. We're going to identify the tools that we're going to use for this. We're going to come to a consensus on which tools we're going to use to train and I mean, even if you can do incremental steps, I think that would be
Pick a
worthwhile.
curriculum. We're going to utilize this. We have to add this to the lecture so that they understand the some of the acronyms that they use, the spikes, and what protocols we want for delivering bad news. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I thought they did a really good job of in this paper is identifying that this was already part of the, they didn't replace or add I mean, they didn't add anything time. This wasn't an additional curriculum. This was embedded in there. And like they used a term I thought was interesting, and I can't remember what it was, but it had to do with like they used their existing curriculum, the existing time within their curriculum. So I thought that was very important for anybody on the outside going, well, who has the time to do this? You'd have to add it on. No, Breaking Bad News is already a piece of it's already a competency that's in their curriculum. So what all they did was change the pedagogy, was say, this is what we're going to do for this piece, not so it wasn't an additional thing. And I thought that was an important thing for anybody who's looking to adopt it. You're looking to replace what you do in currently.
I also think like this wouldn't be something I would want to be optional. I think it's valuable enough that everyone should be doing the training, but there's some emotional context that comes with this and some heavy processing time where I think sometimes we think like, oh, could I take the curriculum, throw it online, make it an optional activity for students to do when we're in the module? And there's plenty of topics that are good for that. I don't think I would put this one in that same context. Same thing, I think this is more than a 20-minute lecture. You really have to practice doing this. I will say one of the biggest things I hear from our folks that do the continuing education is communication, 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 especially in these sort of 18 to 26-year-old demographic. They're like, they just don't talk to patients as well as like others do. So it's something we try and embed. So to me, this is a great opportunity to like actually get them doing that. So that would be my thought on it too.
So the objective of the actual study is to assess feasibility and the educational impact of this virtual. So this is where the scalability comes in, virtual across three states, so Delaware, Illinois, and Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania, multi-center simulation-based mastery learning, Breaking Bad News curriculum in three emergency medicine training programs. There were some family practitioners, I think, in there too, family medicine practitioners. So this, there's a, like I said, each one of these has its own discussion, right? So virtual, first of all, the multi-center, the simulation-based mastery learning, the Breaking Bad News curriculum, and that it's in an emergency medicine training program. Now, I'm going to sit here for a little bit because the methodology on this, I think, is so key. And I love this figure that they have here. So we know the purpose. This is how they actually did this. They ended up, they had about, I think, 50 eligible candidates in the emergency medicine. And then, like I said, a couple of family medicine, I believe. They did consent. They consented 31. And 28, I think they had to meet eligibility. And then 31 were consented. 28 actually ended up completing. The three that couldn't had scheduling issues later on in the process. So this is their process. And basically, a simulation-based mastery learning usually has a pre-test intervention post-test, but the intervention is a deliberate practice in mastery learning. And if the post-test identified, no matter what you're doing, this is usually the process. In the post-test, if they identify that you haven't met their minimum performance standard, then you go back and you get more deliberate practice mastery learning alongside an expert so that you can achieve mastery. And so that's what we're looking at here, but we're looking at it specifically with Breaking Bad News. So you can see here, and this is what I thought was really interesting. So the pretest is a virtual one-on-one encounter with a standardized patient, and standardized patients were trained. They went through a standard protocol for 3 hours that they have a training with them. The scenario was a to disclose to a standardized patient that the brain image showed a mass that was suspicious for cancer. They videotaped these and they later reviewed them. So if you were the learner, you were doing a standardized patient encounter, you were disclosing that this image was suspicious for cancer, and then that was recorded. Then later it was reviewed by one of their reviewers. Again, their reviewers are trained, that was the authors. And then they were emailed, the learner was emailed the assessment. Now, the other thing I thought was is great about this is they show keys to scalability. These are the things that were keys to the ability to be able to scale this to three different sites. And if I used one word to describe it, it would be flexibility. So they offered flexible, three pretest sessions, 15 time slots. They selected their time slot, their preferred time slot. They were open to learners at all sites. So they basically shared resources and they were able to select.
I thought the same thing, Megan, and I especially appreciated that they reviewed it and emailed it to you. I could see I would cringe if it was like, here, we recorded you, and now someone's gonna sit with you and watch, like an expert's gonna sit with you and watch you, and you're gonna sit together. I'd be like, oh. So I can appreciate the fact that like, hey, someone reviewed this, they sent you the feedback. When you're, by yourself in your house where no one else can watch you being recorded, right? Like, I'm not going to listen to myself at Starbucks. So you're sort of in a in your own sort of cocoon, if you will, to do this and to watch the feedback and to receive the feedback. So I actually appreciated that because I thought to myself, gosh, if I was in this position, I would appreciate that much more than like someone being there, like live in person, we're giving you real feedback and you're watching yourself, because that's already sort of cringy, I think. Or I feel like watching myself is cringeworthy.
All right,
Yeah,
Katie.
it also just allows you to, like Megan was saying, flexibility. The person who's the expert that's going to evaluate doesn't have to be available at the same time that the learner's available, which just, I think that sometimes we don't leverage that nearly enough in EMS education, right? Like, we could have wonderful anesthesiologists and EM physicians and everything give feedback on intubation practice, but we never send it to them, right? We're like, oh, if they can't make it to the one day that we have to do training, then there's no point. But we all have cameras. I mean, everyone has like a smartphone that has a camera now that's better than some of the cameras they use in Hollywood to make movies. So this idea of you can have someone evaluate asynchronous for the time, I think is key here. And then in their thing, it's like too that they shared teaching responsibilities. I think it's really difficult to expect an educator to be an expert in everything, especially like with this how broad paramedicine is getting, right? So like I've never attended a workshop like this. How would I know how to do breaking like bad news? Why would I be the one that has to just do this checklist? But Megan, she's an expert. She's an hour down the road and can connect to her virtually. Why not share this responsibility with her? So
Those are silos that really need to be broken down, right? This inner, the, I mean, you have to figure these are three different institutions, three different sets of faculty who work for those institutions, students who are inside different institutions, and they're sharing these resources. And I think, I just love it. I think that's great. And that's a barrier that would need to be broken down, that just doesn't seem to register, I think, sometimes with maybe administrators or whatever.
we
That
don't share enough.
totally.
We don't.
Yes. Let's look at the workshop itself then. So that's the pretest. So the pretest, they're going to have less intervention, or less, work with an instructor, because you're getting kind of a baseline assessment. The workshop is now a 3 hour total workshop, and they use these, again, they have a lot of sort of evidence-based standardized curricula that they anchor to. Their faculty have been anchored to something called EM Talk, a workshop, or that method. And then there was another one that oh, Vital Talk. The standardized patients were using a Vital Talk approach. I've never heard of either one of these. So these are things to kind of look up. What sort of standardized assessments that have been, backed by evidence that they used, or training programs. So this workshop, the interesting thing about this is the way that this is done. So they actually have it down. They have the first hour of the workshop had three parts: a 20-minute lecture on breaking bad news using the Spikes protocol that Mike mentioned earlier, and responding to emotion with empathy using the nurse mnemonic. So there's both of those have references and evidence behind them, and that's a 20-minute lecture. Notice that. Then a demonstration of a breaking bad news encounter by one of the expert faculty. And then the third thing is time for learners to review their pretest performance and commit to individualized learning goals. I love that second part. I always think of Kim. Kim couldn't make it, but I know she loved this study. And that part really makes me think of her. Students are always, not always, but a lot of times resistant to be very specific about their own performance and making a plan. What is your plan to improve in this area? And I love that they did that. This is only the first hour, so they have a 20-minute lecture, they've got a demonstration, they've got a time for them to review their own pretest performance and commit to learning goals and say, okay, based upon what I just learned in the lecture and in this demonstration, I looked at mine and these are the things I'm going to work on. And then they spend 2 hours of virtual deliberate practice. And if sure people are familiar with deliberate practice, but it's effortful practice, it's focused on your areas of need. It's not just blathering a checklist as though each item is equivalent. You hear us talk about this all the time, so people are probably familiar with deliberate practice. And using those breaking bad news skills, they use small groups with standardized patients and 3 clinical cases. So that was their program, their workshop. And again, faculty sharing teaching responsibilities, expertise across sites, 3 sessions, integrating their, oh, protected educational time. That was the term, protected educational time, meaning that was part of their education to begin with. So that was the workshop. Did you guys have any input on that, on how have you ever done anything like this where you've done a virtual workshop?
During COVID we had to, and that was actually one of the things. Like we our students at UCLA, when I was doing the paramedic program there, the feedback was that they found it so beneficial to have time just to practice talking with a patient because they were Zooming, so we weren't doing the procedural skills, we were just doing the talking. But they actually ended up getting much higher scores on exams after we gave them time to like do communication and work with like assessment taking. But the thing that I found at Santa Rosa, we did a lot of like video review for the students, and this idea of deliberate practice, like picking something that you have to improve on, I think that's actually a skill too, that like it wasn't what they're trying to teach the people here, but embedding this kind of practice in your training will help people be able to set goals. Because I know my students now are like, oh, I was disorganized in my assessment, and I'm like, okay, well, what are you going to specifically do to improve? But like next time I'll be more organized. It's like that's not how it works. You can't just magically say like I won't forget next time. And it's like, but what will you do to not forget? Like we have to, and that I think especially in our younger learners, which is a lot of our people coming in as EMTs and new entry paramedics, they're 18, 19, 20 years old. They don't have, I mean, like when you've been in a career for years, every year you have to meet with your supervisor and set like goals. And what are you going to do? How are you going to improve to get your performance evaluation? They don't have any experience with that. So this is part of a learning how to learn situation.
I think what you're saying too is something that a lot of educators, you may be doing certain things already that are founded in evidence, but or that are grounded in evidence, but you don't realize it. And when you hear that it is, you're like, okay, let me pull that on that and add to it. And so I do think that there's a piece of that there's educators that are doing best practices without realizing that that is a best practice. And now need to kind of emphasize, dig into it, highlight it, and then spread it, throughout their faculty workforce.
But this
So.
idea of having like written something you can reflect on past performance to be able to chew new. I mean, I so many times we're like, okay, next person, that was fine, you did okay. And there's not like, we just give verbal feedback that they can't reflect on when they go to the next room and be like, oh, we're just expecting them to remember it. And here they were given tools to write down notes to like take, like they have job aids for learning, like I'm a fan of job aids, but.
Well, videotape, so the combination, having a chance to watch yourself on videotape and then having a prompt or a tool that draw that com that connects that dot specifically to, did you make eye contact with the patient? Just certain specific things to be able to look for in your videotape. I think that makes things much more powerful.
I also appreciated the small group style. So I feel like half the questions I ask in my assessment are because I heard someone else ask that question. I'm like, oh, that's a really good way to say that. I'm going to say it like that going in the future. So I can appreciate that everybody brings some different expertise to it. I mean, even in their survey, they asked if you had like some palliative care experience. Have you ever had to deliver death notifications before? So I thought that that was key because I could see myself sitting in that position and being like, oh, yeah, I'm going to say it like that next time because someone else said it so much better. And same thing for someone else. So the more experience you have, that's your opportunity to share some of that experience. So I appreciated that. A few small groups, getting everybody a little bit of shared knowledge, always key.
And when you hear small groups, a lot of people think the same thing. Well, we don't have the resources. There's always the discussion about resources. And then, that's moving from we don't have it to how do we do this? And that's why I love these keys to scalability. Sharing resources, rotating groups, allowing learners to have, their own preferred time to record and the faculty their own preferred time to review. So I think that was, super key. So then we have you notice there's an arrow coming back up to the workshop later, and that's because the post-test occurs. That's a virtual one-on-one encounter with a standardized patient that has a case that's associated with it. There's three sessions, 15 open time slots. So again, you have this learner preference. I can pick a 30-minute time slot at my convenience to do this post-test virtual encounter. And then those are assessed by the experts, again, using a standardized tool that we'll see in a minute. And then there's feedback by email, again, feedback. And there's either you met the 80% minimum passing standard, or you didn't meet the minimum passing standard. And if you didn't, this is the point where I love the whole concept of deliberate practice and mastery learning. Then that those specific things are fed back into an additional one-on-one session where you and it's a 60-minute time slot. So it's an additional hour that you spend with a faculty and a standardized patient until you pass that standard. And that's this whole concept rather than you didn't meet the cut score, you're gone. It's that mastery learning, that deliberate practice and mastery learning identifies that every student's going to have a weak area, whatever it is, and might need a little more attention in there. And so that's what they did here. That's the process they used. And then the curriculum was completed after everybody passed. So that was the, again, that virtual platform allowed them to not have to book rooms and to do all kinds of other things. So when you think about, well, yeah, that's, additional places that you need to have, not if it's virtual. So in this case, using the virtual platform really was a key to scalability. I'm wondering if you guys have any feedback on the on just on the or any input on this whole process. I thought this methodology, it's the best part is it's based on evidence too. So the whole thing was based on evidence. And then afterwards, one of the things I didn't show here is they also did as usual. So the primary outcome measure is going to be the post-test scores, but it also they did a survey, a post, intervention survey as well to find out whether or not the how they felt in their terms of their confidence, but not just their confidence in delivering bad news and the delivery, but also in I thought that was an interesting thing, navigating the emotional elements of the patient and family. And so that was, I thought, an important one. And then the virtual platform, they wanted to see how they felt about the virtual platform. Incidentally, they did this identical intervention in person. And so they had an in-person published piece of research to compare this group to as well, to see if the virtual platform worked, as well as the others, the in-person. Okay, results. So here's the first one. This is demographic. So this is just the demographic characteristics of the residents. And like Mike said earlier, we wanted to see, they really wanted to see like what kind of experience did they have related to breaking bad news. So you see the basic demographics here. Most of the residents are male. Most of them did not or did have some formal
Yeah,
training. Yeah, most of them did have some formal training.
What I think is so interesting, because I'd love to like dig into that a little bit more. Like, was it a lecture that you had where they're just like, this is how you deliver bad news? Okay, great. Now go out and do it.
Yeah, because it does say formal training, so that suggests that it was conducted at an educational institution or you know, that was part of some sort of program.
But I mean, we're gonna see it here. They did terrible on the pretest. Like 50% of them had formal training in this, and their scores like do not reflect that that training was in any way successful.
None of, and they also, I like that they asked about the palliative care though. Did you have a, you know, really wanted to think about everything. If you had a palliative care rotation,
You
had
better.
some of this.
I also wondered, they asked within the last 12 months, how frequently have you done, had this conversation? Five of them said a few times a week.
Yes.
Like, what specialty are you in as a medical student where someone is expecting you to deliver this
PM.
news?
PM. Yeah.
These are
Emergency
emergency
medicine.
residents.
Yeah, so I would imagine it would be. There's a few times a month, once a week, a few times a week, and that is the majority of them. And then there's a few that are a few times in the last year. But yeah, there's a little, yeah. Most of them, yeah, have had to have this done. Most of them have had formal training, and yet we're going to see in a second. Sorry, my dog is weighing in. So, I will shut that down. But how frequently in the last year have you shared a patient? Was another interesting one. So that with palliative care clinician. So I thought that was an interesting question as well.
I think it's
Okay.
especially interesting when you compare the personal conversation with bad news that like 18% is doing this a few times a week, but no one a few times a week is doing like engaging with palliative care. So there, to me, there seems to be some kind of gap there.
Sorry, I had to keep my dogs at bay here. Okay, so let's look at this then. Let's look at the results here. And what we're seeing here is the performance of the residents. This is a breakdown of the Breaking Bad News protocol and their general communication skills, which I really appreciated also that you actually have sort of a general communication skills and the delivery of Breaking Bad News, the specific things. So the thing that kind of stuck out to me was looking in the left column, you have the pretest items, and then you have the mastery post-test items. And you obviously mastery post-test is going to be greater than 80%. But the pretest, I don't know about you guys, but I just, slid right down and looked at, which ones really stood out as being like really poor. And I was actually surprised at a couple of them. The one about using the word cancer. So what did they say? I mean, not using the word cancer, did they just avoid it because they're not, that's not their specialty? I mean, or they,
Well, they're
why
also
do
using
that?
medical jargon. So they might be saying things like you have a glioblastoma, like they're
Oh,
instead of
true.
saying you have cancer. So I'm thinking there's some of that there.
I kept going back to like, this is the ACLS video on delivery of death notifications where like, say the word died, right? Avoid all the other things that mean died, but don't actually say it. And I just kept going back to like, we harped this on all, like, this isn't new. We've harped this for forever. And it's still showing up here too, where they are just trying to hide behind the language.
And then discussing the plan only after the patient asks to or gives permission to, that was 21%.
Yeah, that one stood out to me too. Like, what'd you had 15 minutes. What'd you talk about? Like, if it was me, I'd be like, great, so how do we fix this?
Well, it's super interesting. There's a lot of research too around that if you deliver bad news and then you deliver the care plan to together before the patient's ready, they don't hear anything. Right. So they just have heard that like you have cancer. And then here's all the things we're gonna do. And then they don't remember any of the things you said we're gonna do because they're still in that period of I just found out I had cancer. So we know that there needs to be this kind of like you need to be able to move from getting the bad news to what's happening next. And if you're not ready and the physician just goes through it. I thought it was super interesting though, because they got faster when they got better. So here, they're not even waiting for the patient to be ready for the news, and they're still taking longer to get through the conversation, and they're not doing it in a way that is patient-centered. And then when they get to mastery, it's significantly more patient-centered and faster. So it's more efficient.
It's deliberate. I think that's why it's deliberate. And
Yeah.
that's that whole deliberate practice when you have that structure to go by and the training, in that. I think that makes a huge difference. Asking permission before delivering the news, that was really low in the first. I thought that was really interesting. I mean, that seems like a, if for people who had formal training, I would expect some of these to be higher. So.
Well, for me, like thinking about how this translates to EMS, one of the things that I think we always struggle with, and I don't know if this you guys can say if it's different, but there is like, well, we don't have time to be empathetic and communicative on scene. We got to get on, like, this is an emergency. They either come in the hospital with us or they're not. And I'm like, yeah, but that actually takes longer. Like, if you're using this empathetic, patient-centered communication, it's more efficient. And like taking the time to teach people these communication skills will actually improve like what we're thinking about, like system status management, right? Everyone's like, we don't have enough people, we don't have enough units, we are like holding the wall for too long. So maybe it's because we don't have these kinds of skills and we're not focusing on them.
Well, I've heard people say too, well, just be human, just say what you would want to hear. And it's like, I don't know
Yeah.
how also how culturally relevant that would be as well. So there's, we're gonna, and we'll talk about this a little bit too. I mean, they go through some limitations related to the research, but there's also limitations related to just, what are the limitations of the tools when it comes to things like language, and culture and that kind of thing. So that'll be, something else, and that's a whole other topic. But the ones below, the general patient-centered communication skills, just the name of that category suggests that, okay, these are the things you should be coming in with, regardless of whether it's bad news or not. And that's, using summary statements to ensure understanding of the patient's or family's statements, was very, I mean, it was really low, but it actually didn't really get too much better afterwards. So I'm not exactly clear on what exactly was being looked for in those. There were some where it was a checklist, and there
These
are
are all
others
yes
where
or
there's
no.
scales. Yeah, these are all yes or
Yeah,
no.
all yes or no. I think this is interesting too because, like, knowing the study population is EM residents, they all had to go through multiple like communication OSCE kind of such like standardized testing to get to this point in their career. So this might also be speaking to like, well, yeah, we test it, they do fine on the test, but then what's happening in practice? Where are, like, is the culture of our actual practice making people worse because they probably scored much higher when they passed, their boards and their medical school, standardized testing for patient encounters. And now they've been out in the actual emergency rooms. Have they gotten bad habits from people that are like working there, the people that are burned out, just the system itself? Is it creating this problem?
Let's see anything else in here. I think everything is we've covered everything in here, but now we've got their scaled items. So they had the dichotomous variable, the yes, no, did they do it or not? And now we have the two things. One is a behaviorally based, scaled items where they skilled or not skilled on a 1 to 5 scale, or was it, strongly agree or disagree on a Likert scale? So these were the scaled items. And you can see again going from pretty low scores to begin with, like really nobody even got 50% on these, to the mastery post test of 100% across the board. And again, deliberate practice. I mean, I just imagine without the intervention, this is what's, this is what we're kind of sending out there, and not to be too harsh on it, but when you're talking, how good are they at verbally responding to their patient's emotions, or their family's emotions? Overall, how was their communication with the family? 21%, were rated as not as below. So these are, sent against the percentage that are rated, below 4 or 5. And so, yeah, you're seeing some pretty low scores here.
Yeah, 75% of the people cannot get a 4 or 5. Like, they disagreed that they clearly communicated what was happening. That's That's
Yeah, or
crazy.
acknowledging the impact of the news on the family. That was the other one, acknowledging that there's an impact. So I guess some of that comes from that empathy scale that you were mentioning, Michael. And I don't know, did you put those links in the chat for?
I did. I put a good summary article that talks about different ways of delivering bad news. So they used the ones they taught were spikes and a nurse mnemonic. And they're actually really interesting. I put the most detailed article I could find on. There's some that are specific to just each one of them. But like the nurse mnemonic, like I think this is all really helpful because I think scripting is always really helpful when you don't know what to say to rely on something that you've used in the past. So like the nurse mnemonic is naming, understanding, respecting, supporting, and exploring. It's not super hard. It's things like, I'll be with you during the treatment. Tell me more about your concerns about the side effects. It sounds like you're worried about dot dot dot. Whereas I feel like, I don't know, I feel like some of these things would be really helpful if you had no experience, but these people were all like, their average age, I was 29. So like these people have some life experience where you would hope that they've heard these things before, and could sort of replicate them into the field. So I do think there's probably some things in here they probably wouldn't know, like everything from your setting. I know in the emergency department, if you're in a nice, well-funded emergency department, you probably have a quiet room where you can go to and deliver this news. In a busy urban center, that's maybe not the case. So I think those things do play into how you set up for your success. But again, I appreciated the scripting that they provided them. So like, here are some things you can say if you don't know what else to say, to sort of drive the conversation forward. But yeah, I'm happy to see so much improvement, I guess, because it's a little sad on the beginning part of it, but they clearly improved.
Yeah, and I think that goes with, there's other communication tools that are not in just breaking bad news, but things like validating how someone feels, validation. So you can see that embedded in here that making sure that you're recognizing, navigating the emotional responses, but validating how the patient and the family feel. And then this is the in figure two, they put it all sort of on a, I actually appreciated this visualization. They put it all on one kind of chart so that you could see this kind of speaks to educators because you're looking at the whole, minimum passing standard line across the, the horizontal line or like right across the center of the screen, which is 80%. And then you're seeing, where things fall below and above the line. And the different things are, sometimes a student would pass the portion that of the dichotomous variables, the checklist, but not the scaled items, or they pass both. And in the pretest, you did have some people that were above the minimum passing standards to begin with, and they remained there. And you saw that in one of the tables too. I forgot to point that out, that there were a couple of areas where they came in already, strong. Some people came in, actually, a lot of them came in strong. And then some of the other items, or most of the other items, they fell below the minimum passing standard. But you can see just looking at it from pretest to initial post-test that the majority of the participants were came in above after the intervention. And then the ones that you see with the that fell below were the ones that went back into the mastery, the 1 hour deliberate practice with an expert feedback. And then mastery post-test, all of them came in or above the minimum performance standard. So I think there's, like I said, there's so much to unpack in here. And one of those that stands out to me is that this whole concept of mastery learning, of deliberate practice and mastery learning. So I'd love to hear what people think about, especially Bill Toon, Katie, Mike. I mean, I'd love to hear what you think about the future of EMS education in terms of this. We are so stuck on time, and this future of time versus competency-based learning. We keep hearing people talk about it, and we've talked about it. We have competencies. They're not perfect. They need to be developed. We should have probably more in communications and other areas, especially with given the evidence here that maybe in breaking bad news, as something that should develop in competencies, but we still are stuck so much stuck on time and resources, and we get caught in that. How do we get out of this?
I mean, this is
Pregnant
something
pause.
I harp on all the time, right? Like, if you're tracking something, if you're measuring something, you're saying it's important. And in EMS education and some of it, like the ways we accredited programs, we get real ticky-tacky about a thing. Like you have to document how many times they did something, not their mastery, not where they got, like where they got to. It's just how many times, like checkbox, how many times did they do this? How many like adult patients did they see? Not how many like adult patients were they empathetic with, but how many did they see? And there's nothing that I can find that says like if you see this many human beings, you are good, right? Like so we're just tracking numbers and we're tracking hours like for continuing education. I know registry is really working to get rid of this, but for some reason we value you must do 25 IVs and then you will be, I think it's 75, right? Like if you do 75 IVs, you are competent at IV, which is not true at all. And like this demonstrates right here that different people need different types of interventions and different amount of time with it, right? Some people needed the extra one-on-one. They needed 45 more minutes. And, you know, does it mean that the person who did it in 30 minutes or the person who started out fine didn't benefit anyway from this training? Like they maybe increase their scores too, but they didn't need that extra time. So we're putting people and like making them do this many pediatrics, and they're holding off on being able to graduate until they find that one less than 24-hour patient, and that's going to make them a good paramedic,
Well,
right?
that's what
That like
we have an
one tick
interpretation
box.
problem too, because we keep interpreting things as a number of tables, and in the table it'll say successful, but then we haven't defined success. So that's the real key, because then it doesn't say, X number of patients. It says successful assessments. But then we have to say, okay, OB labor, we know that now we can simulate those, because we know. Watch, you're going to be watching. Your odds are you're not going to be delivering that baby. So how can, different instructors are going to say, I can't rate this as a successful. I can't rate it at this because they didn't go in there and do it. Well, then if they don't, then they don't meet the standard. Well, if they, so now you can meet the standard because you can simulate it. Simulation is acceptable for neonatal resuscitation and or newborn care and complex OB and things like that. And then you look at others where it's like, okay, we have to have these many contacts with a patient, but it says successful, successful. And so then the program's got to define what success is. And that's where I think we kind of fall off, and it is this consensus around, how to get success. And those are the details. That's where it's like, okay, where do we define that? How is that defined? And how can we make it more like this is where, they've done a ton of work to build the evidence around what they've defined as success. And so I think, yeah, we've got a lot of work to do in that area.
I was gonna say, I
Yeah, I mean,
appreciate
but
that.
they,
Sorry, go
oh,
ahead,
sorry, go
Kate.
ahead, Mike.
Nope,
Well, I was gonna
yeah, I'm
say,
gonna
like,
change
at the
topics. Go.
beginning, they say that these are like required in graduate medical education,
Yeah.
these skills are required. And that's why it's like in paramedic, we don't have that. We don't say that it's required to have these skills to be a good paramedic. We say, you know, you have to be able to do this, you have to do this, and they're all psychomotor skills. And then we have like at the end, two things like, and be good, like, and be empathetic.
Yeah, and not a agreed upon evidence-based tools to get us there.
I appreciate the focus on communication. I think it segues a little bit in the like, congratulations, you did all these skills and you ran a simulation, but you didn't talk to the patient. Your patient didn't feel any empathy from you. Congratulations, you're still the paramedic, right? And I think you could probably say the same for medical school, but there's a ton more focus on the OSCEs and the patient perception of the conversation. So I can appreciate the amount of work they put into developing that, but this focus on we want the provider to build that rapport with the patient, it is totally possible to do within the short time we're with our patients. So I just one of the takeaways I have on here is like, it's not how great your airway success is. It's how well you can communicate with someone. And I appreciate that the authors took an approach that said, like, this is something we consider, deeply important.
Equally important.
Yeah.
Dr. Toon.
Is this an, first of all, I think EMS education in some ways has made some great leaps and bounds, but it doesn't
I
mean
agree.
we're there yet. And We're always probably going to be this supply and demand type thing, where people want, they want bodies in the seat and they want them within a specific period of time. They can budget this amount of time for them. So that's a reality. I don't think it's right. I would like to see a model that is more develops a practitioner more, such as an internship, but maybe there is some more postgraduate, maybe there needs to be some more structured postgraduate education that could be developed, and maybe just guidelines that would help the educators within and the field training officers within these organizations to help bring these people along over X amount of time. I mean, we may need to be more creative, but we certainly need to be doing more classroom research. It would be great to see someone take this study and modify it, to the EMS, particularly at the ALS level, and publish their results of what they learned, from that, because this is again a nice little, there could be a nice little turnkey they could do with this. Maybe they don't need to be as long, since we're really only dealing with death notifications. So I don't know. I in my world, I'd like it entirely different, but the rea and then I also have to be in the real world, which I have to struggle with all the time, and my fantasy world is much better. So, but I do think we have an opportunity, and this is a great one. Death notification, has been a big thing that apparently providers still feel very uncomfortable with, when you look at the practice analysis and stuff, so there's a need maybe for some greater standardization in the training modules, to help educators do this better for their
Yeah, and
students and stuff.
standardization with, but allowing some flexibility too for
Absolutely.
creativity, right? That's the
Absolutely.
hard, that's always the tension is if you standardize too much, then everyone
Create
has to
the
do it a particular way. And
floor, not the ceiling. And
exactly. And that's
I think that if we have a floor, that then what goes beyond the floor has to be based upon the resources and capabilities of the institution that they're
yeah.
at. So I think that that's something that we can do, but there is so much of that that varies, throughout all of EMS education. And I see it within the textbooks all the time.
It does really beg the question, especially as we start looking at like associate's degree programs. Like you could have a class on the different communications with your patients, right? There's a whole some other aspects that could be included in there, but it really does beg the question as you start looking at like, well, how do we really formalize paramedicine into a degree program? This is a very vital part of being a good paramedic. That likely should be included in that class load somewhere. So, because I think if you do start looking at 2 years for an associate's degree, there probably is that time where you could embed this in.
Well, and
And
I would beg to differ with you. I said, I think that some people, because of the credit hours that are typically awarded for paramedic education, it leaves very little that they need for the associate's degree. And it varies by state by state by state, but I would like to see, I would like to see in an anatomy and physiology program that's really geared more towards emergency healthcare providers. What do they need to know versus the generic A&P that's given within a school, but I would like there to also to be a class on ethics that they would take, communications, death and dying, death notification. I mean, the list can go on and on, and I almost wonder if we shouldn't try to create the model for some time down the road and develop those modules and allow organizations to begin to plug them in if they have it, or it can become continuing education. I would love to see some continuing education programs other than the CAN programs we have now that I don't think really help people as much as I wish they would.
I think part of this too is what we're struggling with in at least in the US with what is the identity of EMS, right? Like are we medicine? Are we first responders? Are we some kind of hybrid between it? Because I think of like you're saying that we don't have enough credit hours, but we have there's an entire EMS operations section with stuff that isn't really related to medicine, right? Like the having to know the landing grade for a helicopter, how big a helicopter landing field has to be, where do you park an ambulance? Like those things maybe don't belong in a paramedic curriculum, right? Like maybe they belong in an ambulance operator curriculum. And you could have, you know, separate roles, or someone could take both. But we kind of seem to want to like shove a whole bunch of other stuff into medicine, and at the like expense of we don't have time for medicine.
That is a really interesting point, because one of the things I remember coming out of EMT school being so shocked about was, how do I drive this thing? You know, nobody taught me how to drive. I mean, the fact that, of course, we didn't have EVOC or anything then, but we had this, you know, employer-based something. And, you know, they're talking about the 80s too. So don't be offended if you're an employer out there and you have way better than we did. But that's a, and think about the simulations you could do in that EVOC or you know, just even that piece of it. But
we're actually looking at that right now, because I'm ironically, the police simulators, the driving, like automated VR stuff that they use, all have ambulances. You can change the vehicle to a SUV, to a fire truck. And it's like, what, like we, this is down the street. We could send students down here and use it. And they're like, oh yeah, it's an ambulance. There's an ambulance built into it. And you're like, really? We had no idea. So I think as we start looking at all those questions, like why are we at a higher propensity for collisions? This maybe it's because we have very little training in it. But then you go back to like, why do we have a, why are all these people saying I have formal training in delivering bad news, but according to this study, you're not very good at it without a little additional formalized training? So I think that's maybe part of it.
I mean, we see tons of these kinds of interventions too on things like triage and handling mass casualties, because we do it so terribly. But like that's, it's its own skill set. And we just try to shove everything and we're like, you know what, an EMT can know a little bit of everything and they'll be fine. And they don't have to have any on the job training. They could literally get hired and just go sit in the front or start driving an ambulance, right? Like, I don't know if the certification is really training to the job that they perform, especially when you think of like how much time they spend practicing CPR. It's almost like if you took an EMT class, you would think that everyone that you go see is bleeding or in cardiac arrest.
Or an MCI.
Like with the amount of time. Or an MCI. Those are like the things you're going to see. And then you get there with the diabetic patient who's like borderline, probably doesn't need to go to the hospital, and you don't.
Or you do a lot of patient movement as an EMT also. A lot of, you know, draw sheeting and, you know, all these things that, you know, is draw sheeting a separate skill? Nope.
That's not a skill sheet that you have to pass. You have to pass the verbalized tourniquet skill sheet, but not the actual moving a patient.
No one says you have to use, there's no skill sheet for a stair chair or a gurney, yet you are going to do a ton of it. And it's probably one of the riskier things you will do in terms of injury.
For both parties. For the provider and the patients.
Interesting stuff. The other thing I wanted to mention before we close up is that they do talk about further research. So the thing that one of the limitations of this is, of course, it's an immediate result. So what's going to be the effect on retention, on skills retentions, and their ability to hold on to it and then transfer it to their clinical practice? So knowing this group, they'll follow up on that, and we'll get more information on this. And if you're not familiar with them, the Feinberg School of Medicine, and that's the Northwestern, the one in Chicago, they are the ones, I think, who published the paper on the was central line insertion, simulation-based mastery learning and central line insertion in residents. And they took it all the way to translation level 4 out to return on investment, because it reduced the number of infections that they saw in the hospital, which reduced the length of stay in the hospital, which showed a financial savings. So they were able to go from simulation-based mastery learning in their residents all the way to the financial benefits, which was a real gold standard piece of educational research. And that's the same group. So I'd love to see their long-term outcomes on something like this. Does this translate? And then does it translate, especially at the very start of this, we talked a little bit about burnout. You know, does it translate into job satisfaction when people are armed with better communication skills and tools? You know, will they be more likely to feel like they can handle certain situations and maybe stay a little longer in the profession? Any final thoughts?
I'll leave with saying, Katie, please, ladies first.
I was gonna say, like, it's more efficient. Like, they're doing better. They feel better. Like, clearly here, it just seems like a no-brainer.
Dr. Toon?
And I think I like the study. I would love to see an EMS education program incorporated, but I'd also like to see it done, you know, in an agency to see how it can impact, you know, the people feeling in the agency as a continuing education mm-hmm. versus part of initial education. And, you know, just I want to seed something in someone's mind longitudinally. It would be very interesting if we could start tying the data that is collected, whether it be in FSDAP or some other similar program, tie that directly to their performance in the National Registry exam, and then tie it directly to the EPCR for actual patient outcomes. Mm-hmm. And let's look at how someone is trained initially, how they do on their credentialing, not only their, and I think they should look at their credentialing, the whole process of their evaluation, and then what's their practice in the field, and see if that kind of connectivity can help us in the future develop better educational or continuing education programs for people.
Great. Anything?
Bravo to the authors. This is a great study. It begs a ton of questions, and I appreciate that they look specifically at feasibility. How can mm-hmm. we employ this in different places and in more medical schools, residency training, all of the above?
Yep. Okay. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Join us next time, Friday, August 23rd. We're going to talk about growth mindset messages from instructors and whether they improve academic performance among first-generation college students. Thank you to Sahej Khalsa for sending us this great article. If you would like another one before then, go to the PCRF Clinical Journal Club on Monday, August 12th with Dr. Tony Fernandez and Dr. Remley Crow. And remember, you could join us live each month. You can register at prehospitalcare.org and go see our archives if you miss any of our past episodes. You want to review them. See you next time.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.